Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Network. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for tuning in this week. The Pentagon Space Development Agency is only about a year and a half old, but on Friday, the agency awarded a contract that will go a long way toward fulfilling one of its main missions, building a new architecture of low Earth orbit satellites. They'll detect military threats and move data to and from the battlefield. The $18 million task order for Mission Systems Engineering and Integration went to Perspecta. It is one of several new contracts SDA is working on to build that new National Defense Space Architecture. And as we'll talk about later in the hour, even though SDA is moving very quickly to make those contract awards, at least so far, it's doing it all through the traditional government contracting process, not the newer vehicles like middle-tier acquisition or other transaction authorities that so many other DoD components have been using when they want to go fast. Ryan Prim is Deputy Director of the Space Development Agency. He talked with me about the new architecture and how SDA is building it. And Ryan, I would like you to spend a little bit of time at the front here talking about exactly what the Space Development Agency is. You know, you guys came into being kind of at the same time two other big space organizations did, and people may not be tracking roles and responsibilities of each of those three. So talk a little bit about kind of core roles and missions of SDA, how you interact with Space Command, Space Force, other elements of DoD in the space enterprise.
Sure. Thank you, Garrett. So SDA, the Space Development Agency, was established in March of 2019 as really the department's constructive disruptor for space. Our national defense strategy has clearly articulated a need for us to deploy space capabilities much faster than we have traditionally, primarily in response to adversarial threats, you know, both terrestrially and to our space systems. So SDA was established to get after that problem and in response to that problem. So we're primarily looking to build a proliferated architecture in space as a response to that problem, and looking to field capabilities to the warfighter. There's two primary goals that we have in mind, and that's to deliver beyond line of sight targeting solutions to our warfighters, and as well as detect and track advanced missile threats. Those are our two primary objectives, and all that's underpinned by a proliferated comm backbone that we're calling our transport layer to deliver those capabilities to our warfighters.
And the National Defense Space Architecture that you're working on at the front here, my understanding of it, and tell me if this is a fair characterization, part of it's going to be building new stuff, building new technology, and part of it's going to be kind of orchestrating existing DoD capabilities with that new stuff. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, that's a fair way. I mean, SDA's mission is to take technologies that we think are readily available, that are commoditized, that can be mass-produced so that we can support a proliferated architecture and deploy those rapidly so that we can give capabilities to the warfighters. Now, some of those capabilities we think are gaps that we can fill. Others, we think there's other folks in the community that are working on capabilities that if we integrate into the overall NDSA, we'd be able to provide those same capabilities. So our job is to orchestrate all of that. And when needed, we'll actually develop and acquire and develop space systems for that. But yes, largely the role is to orchestrate that.
The commoditization piece is interesting. Do you have a sense yet for what share of the architecture that mass-produced, commoditized hardware and software is going to make up of the architecture versus sort of exotic military unique capabilities?
A lot of the infrastructure for the architecture we think can be commoditized. You know, we're leveraging a lot of what DARPA Blackjack was doing. And there we've seen that the spacecraft buses, what we're seeing is a lot of the other infrastructure pieces in terms of components of that, the supply chains that support that, as well as optical crosslinks and some of those technologies that can underpin this proliferated architecture are commoditized. Now, there are some specific components that that we need to provide a specific capability to the warfighters. We're looking at implementing tactical data links from space in Tranche Zero, our first tranche that we're going to put up. We're doing that with Link 16 and the integrated broadcast service. So a lot of those are DoD unique applications, but we are driving towards creating a marketplace that supports that, not single vendors. We very much want to avoid that and create an environment where There's a whole market that can provide that, whether they're commoditized or maybe even commoditized for military applications.
This may seem like an obvious question, but it's probably worth spending a minute on it anyway. Can you talk a bit about what you see as the benefits of having sort of a massively distributed constellation out there versus a couple of multi-billion dollar satellites and ground stations?
Sure. I mean, the primary one is resilience. You know, whether in a proliferated architecture, if a single node isn't providing all your mission capability. So if that node went away for whatever reason, maybe it just died from, natural causes, as it were, in space. It's a graceful degradation in mission capability in a proliferated architecture. It's sort of avoids the all eggs in one basket. The other aspect that benefits from proliferation is you have to stand up an ecosystem to support that. So we have an ability to do technology refresh much more rapidly because we're always fielding capabilities in two-year tranches. So we have an opportunity to put up the latest and greatest and spiral up to the desired mission performance. So we'll hit our schedule. If we have to sacrifice a little bit of performance, be it sensitivity on a sensing layer or what have you, we can make that up on the next tranche, and that's only 2 years away.
Yeah, that's actually where I wanted to go to next, is this sort of rapid iterative tranche approach. Talk a bit more about why the department's choosing that path.
I think there's an overall recognition that the warfighters are clamoring for capabilities, and that sometimes the good enough solution in the American warfighter's hands is actually better than the perfect solution too late. So there's a conscious shift to explore this, as I mentioned, in terms of us, SDA being the constructive disruptor, we're sort of given that mantle to try to put capabilities out there faster. And so that's what we're going to do.
So let's talk a little bit about the contract award that you guys made last week to Perspecta for mission systems engineering and integration. Where does that fit into this architecture, and how does it help get you started?
Sure. So Tranche Zero, our warfighter immersion tranche, is the first set of capabilities that we're going to put up to demonstrate this proliferated architecture. That Tranche Zero, consists of two space segments. There's a transport layer, which consists of 20 satellites that provide that comm mesh network backbone, 20 satellites that have optical crosslinks and tactical data links to talk to the tactical users, as well as a tracking layer that consists of 8 satellites with wide field of view OPIR sensors for detection and tracking of advanced missile threats. One ground segment that's provided by the Naval Research Lab through an MOA that we have with NRL, and that's to use their Blossom Point tracking facility to fly and operate this Tranche Zero satellite. And then a launch segment that's out for industry proposals right now to actually put deliver these satellites on orbit at the end of FY22. So the job of the MSDNI is really to pull all those segments together to form an integrated and interoperable Tranche Zero system.
Can you talk about that philosophy a little bit, why you decided to go with a vendor to do all that integration work rather than having the government be the integrator?
Yeah, absolutely. So the MSDNI is a fairly unique scope. There's traditional systems engineering and integration work that needs to be done. There's segments that are being developed under separate contracts that have interfaces that need to be defined and verified. And then all that needs to be pulled together to deliver an overall Tranche Zero mission system. But it's important that contractor or that person that's pulling all of that together has a performer mentality, right? There is it has to be a focus on delivery, not just engineering support or program facilitation. So we thought it was important to actually get an industry partner on board that could actually help us pull all that together, that has that sort of focus on delivery and can pull all these systems together.
And breaking Tranche Zero into multiple contracts, that was a choice, I assume. You guys must have thought about the possibility of just doing one large award for integration and transport and tracking and ground. Why did you ultimately decide to break this into 4 smaller contracts?
We ultimately broke it up because of the different aspects that we wanted to achieve through the various contracts. Through the solicitation and award of the transport and tracking contracts, we really wanted to procure those on firm fixed price contracts. We wanted to demonstrate that we could deliver those on a fixed schedule under a fixed cost, and that industry could support that. We wanted multiple vendors, and so that was the way to go about. We also knew that we wanted to leverage what was out there. NRL is a very helpful mission partner, and so we wanted to take advantage of their capabilities for the ground. And so by having made those choices, that was the best the way to get the best value for the government and ultimately deliver Tranche Zero most effectively.
Ryan Prim is Deputy Director of the Space Development Agency. Short break, and we'll come back in just a minute and talk about how SDA is managing to move through the acquisition process as quickly as it is, using plain old FAR-based contracts. That's next on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Servu. Back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Servu, talking in this part of the hour with Ryan Prim, the Deputy Director of the Space Development Agency, about a contract SDA just awarded to Perspecta. It's a big piece of the puzzle for building the new National Defense Space Architecture SDA was chartered to design. I think one of the most interesting pieces of this award was the speed. I mean, the RFP for the contract we're talking about now was just in June. Got an award 3.5 months later. How did you manage to turn this around so quickly using a traditional FAR-based contract?
Yeah, thanks. There was nothing magic about our contracting approach, as you mentioned. You know, we found that the FAR is actually quite flexible and useful to get things done. And the reason we were able to be successful is because we have a very talented, dedicated, motivated team. And the reason we achieve that is because we share a singular focus. And that's being the department's constructive disruptor for space. And the team knows that we need to get space capabilities out to the warfighter at the speed of need. And the reason we can inculcate that culture is because we are a lean organization and an independent agency. So that becomes much easier. And we know that we have to do our part. The department has given us a mission and an autonomy to execute it. We were resourced and appropriated in FY20 to be able to get started. And we know that national defense is counting on us. So we could take longer in source selection, but we know that's just eating into time to deliver the overall capability. So our team shares that singular focus in terms of speed. And so we're trying to do our part. And in all of this, you know, I have to acknowledge industry's role in that success as well. We asked for a very quick bid and proposal periods, 30 days, the minimum that the FAR allows. During sort of unprecedented times with COVID. And so we received multiple FFP offers in the case of transport and tracking, as well as multiple cost reimbursable bids for the MSE&I. And we know that that is difficult, particularly for the FFPs, to turn that around and get management approval. So I want to acknowledge your part in this quick turnaround for us to be able to make these awards and move out on the capabilities that we desperately need.
And as I look kind of quickly through the performance work statement for this particular contract, my sense of it is you guys were not incredibly specific with your requirements. What I'm trying to say is you really didn't over-specify what you wanted the vendor to do here and gave them quite a bit of flexibility as to how to actually achieve the objectives. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I think you are. And that could be said more broadly for a lot of our acquisitions so far. We know exactly the capabilities we want to deliver, but we don't want to over-specify, right? We want to go out and find industry partners that share that vision and can come back and tell us how they're going to deliver it under firm fixed price contracts where it exists or cost reimbursable ones. And so we did that here with MSE&I. That is the approach we took. You know, we specified the major responsibilities that we wanted from the MSE&I contractor, you know, overall systems engineering and integration, defining and verifying all the interfaces, integrating, gap filling, and delivering the T0 mission system, as well as planning and executing the capstone to demonstrate and validate the mission system in FY23. And we also coupled that with some other approaches that we use, again, are FAR-based. We used oral presentations to help understand the mentality that the teams brought from their key personnel. And that was a significant added value to this approach as well.
And I think as part of that flexibility, one thing you did here is you did the award first, and then you tell the vendor that they've got 30 days to develop a systems engineering and integration plan for how this is actually going to work. Is there some risk to that approach? I mean, what if they come back with a plan that the government thinks is no good?
Well, certainly there's risk for any approach, but the way we mitigate it is we actually asked for drafts of those plans during the actual proposal, and that was considered in our evaluation as well. So from the evaluation on through execution, we had some idea of the risk that we were accepting or that or were not accepting as proposed and as awarded.
Is this kind of speed something you think we should expect to continue to see from SDA in future acquisitions and future tranches as you continue to build out this architecture?
Absolutely. We know, again, we are in fixed schedules to deliver the systems, so we need to be very fast in stating our requirements, soliciting for those requirements, evaluating proposals against those, and getting people on contract. The quicker that we can do the contracting piece, the more time that we give ourselves and our industry partners to actually deliver the systems. And in fact, this morning we're releasing the the RFI for Tranche 1, right on the heels of awarding everything that we need for Tranche 0. And that's because we know the timeline to FY24 isn't much longer than the timeline to FY22. So we're going to put that out there so that we can start work on the next tranche and start thinking about that. Tranche 1 is largely proliferating what will be demonstrated in Tranche 0, but we're still assessing, you know, overall military utility as well as technology and manufacturing readiness levels to define that Tranche 1 minimum viable product. We use our Warfighter Council for the military utility piece of that, but the RFI supports the TRL and NRL market research that we're trying to do. So we're already thinking about Tranche 1 as we look forward to the future.
Yeah, and just to flesh out how you're going to move through these tranches, it sounds like each successive one is going to build on what you learned in previous ones rather than wholesale replacement of the previous tranche each time you deploy a new one.
That's right, and that's critical. In fact, we don't even have the luxury, as I just alluded to in terms of the timing of Tranche 1, to wait for Tranche 0 to complete all the way and document lessons learned. So we're going to take the knowledge that we have through so far in executing Tranche 0. We have some time before we actually release the request for proposals for Tranche 1. So we will take the lessons learned as we receive them, both in executing those contracts as well as what feedback we receive from the warfighter community, and start immediately folding those into Tranche 1. So there will be some overlap in order to us to continue to keep the momentum going and deliver these capabilities.
You gave some credit to your acquisition workforce a little bit ago, and I'm just curious how you built that up. I mean, you guys are a brand new agency, only about a year and a half old. How did you build that workforce? Is it all organic at this point? Did you go poach good people from other elements of DOD, or did you rely on other DOD components contracting offices? How's that all work?
No, we are fortunate to have our own contracting shop. And by shop, that is a small group of people. And when we started, you're exactly right. We started out with a very small team. We've grown a little bit over the past year as we ramp up towards our end strength of about 200 people. And that includes contractor support. We're fortunate to identify a very good contracting cell chief. And we've relied on his network to pull in a few other folks. Right now, we have three warranted contracting officers that are helping us move all of this along very quickly.
And again, just looking toward the future and the sort of acquisition vehicles you might choose to use, do you foresee FAR-based contracts really being the primary thing you lean on? Or, you know, when you actually need to develop a new technology or do some R&D, would some of the new popular things like OTAs and Section 804 authorities come into play?
So we'll look to use whatever is the best tool to get the job done. We, like I said, we found the FAR to be very flexible and accommodating for what we're trying to do, and can use that. We are authorized to use the Section 804 and other transaction authorities, as you mentioned, and we'll consider those. In addition to those contracting types, our mission is to primarily to take technologies that are readily available that can be mass produced and applied to a particular warfighting problem. But we do have limited resources that we can make small but pivotal investments on future tranches to do risk reduction. So we are releasing a small business BAA, broad agency announcement, to look for some areas where we can do partnering with small businesses to reduce risk on future tranches. We have a standing broad agency announcement that's more open to large and small and other partners to do risk reduction of those. So we do have an ability to do R&D, again, as it helps, particularly with being a transition partner with other organizations that might be doing more R&D type activities and folding those into our spiral development model.
Last area I wanted to tackle with you is, you know, you mentioned NRL being a part of Tranche Zero here so far. Talk about other partnerships that you're developing with other government entities and how relationships are going to matter as you continue to build out this architecture.
Sure. The Naval Research Lab has been an excellent partner to date. We established that MOA very early on with them, knowing that they would be able to help us deliver what we needed in Tranche Zero and help us take some of those challenges and risks on our behalf. We are looking to partner with other organizations. The Army is a key one where we're looking to use their Titan system, which is a remote terminal that we'll be able to communicate with so they can distribute and disseminate the information provided by our transport layer out even further to the tactical edge. So that is one key partnership that we're looking at. And there's others that we're looking that are developing space-based sensing capabilities that we're looking to incorporate into our proliferated architecture. Those agencies can deliver those capabilities, but if they have a way to communicate directly with our transport layer via optical crosslink, then we can fuse that data and also disseminate that over the tactical data links that we're already implementing.
And when you look at a partnership with a program like Titan, I assume the main benefit for you guys in developing that early is mostly just to validate whether your architecture works with a real world system.
That's part of it. And we also know that there's, again, in our role as the orchestrator, we know that we don't have to reinvent that wheel. If other agencies or other partners are developing capabilities that overall provide the warfighter the capabilities they need, we're going to look to incorporate that. And Titan's just one such opportunity.
Ryan Prim is Deputy Director of the Space Development Agency. We'll post more information about the Mission Systems Integration and Engineering Contract we've been discussing and the other awards SDA's been working on to build the new National Defense Space Architecture at federalnewsnetwork.com/ondod. Another quick break, and when we come back, some advice for agencies on how to handle identity management securely, even when employees are teleworking. Dr. Alan Lang from the National Security Agency joins us. That's next on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm Jared Serbia. Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm Jared Serbu. With a huge chunk of the federal workforce still working remotely, the PIV cards employees normally use to authenticate themselves on federal networks are not always an option. So many agencies have turned to commercial multi-factor authentication solutions as an alternative. But some of those solutions are more secure than others. To help agencies sort the good from the not-so-good, the National Security Agency has just released a guide to commercial multi-factor authentication. Dr. Alan Lang is Senior Subject Matter Expert for Vulnerabilities and Mitigations at NSA. He talked with me about the new information paper. I think for starters, maybe you can just spend a minute here talking about why NSA decided to release this publication at this particular time. I mean, have you been getting a lot of inquiries from federal agencies and other organizations about multi-factor authentication in these interesting last few months?
So, yes, interesting last months is probably a good term to use. The NSA put out a number of cybersecurity information reports related to our customers trying to continue working. A lot of them were pushed to do telework and things like that. So the multi-factor authentication cybersecurity report was part of that.
And I guess the main takeaway for me here is that in a pinch, almost anything is better than just a username and password. But not all multi-factor authentication schemes are created equal. And just working backwards here a little bit, you specifically call out techniques like text messages, out-of-band SMS messages to your phone, and some of the commercial biometric solutions that are out there as not being the best ideas. Talk a bit about some of the weaknesses there and why you wouldn't necessarily use those as your first go-tos.
Yeah, so the SMS and biometrics have a history of being ineffective at binding the user that is making a request to their digital identity. The NIST report on digital identity guidance describes the rationale for that. Basically, you're leaving your fingerprints and biometrics all over the place, and it's fairly easy to replicate. And then for the SMS, there's a ton of ways to impersonate or to capture the SMS messages. So that was considered not the best way of moving forward.
And the publication, we should tell listeners, does include a list of all the various FIPS-approved solutions that are out there. We certainly can't get into them all in this venue, but can you take us through some of the characteristics that you want to be looking for when you're actually selecting a strong solution?
Given the need to get this out quickly, we have some expertise here, but we wanted to be fair, so we used the criteria in the NIST Digital Guidelines document, the recent update, and we use those criteria for our search of public websites that vendors were advertising solutions that met these criteria. So they're the NIST webpage that has all the validated crypto modules was where we started. And then when we saw the vendors that were validating their products were advertising or indicating that they were compliant or trying to meet the criteria, then we went into those websites and validated those products against the criteria.
Can you take us through what you think the most, or this is almost a NIST question, but what the most important criteria are for determining whether you really can trust a multi-factor authentication scheme?
So there's the cryptographic part of it. Every multi-factor authentication involves some sort of cryptography, whether it's a one-time password or a random number generator. So the independent and standards-based validation that's provided by the FIPS 140-2 validation scheme is probably the most important piece of that. The verifier of the request also needs to be locked down, so they're not just accepting any claim. It has to be also cryptographically and from a network security perspective, it needs to be sound. Those two together, and you see the FIPS validation indications in the report, as well as things like FedRAMP or the NIST 853, which is their security controls document.
And as you also point out in the document, well, you don't point this out, but I'll point it out, not every agency is going to have the option to send government-furnished equipment home with every single employee, but you do point out that that is a better option if you can. Can you talk a bit about why that's the case?
Yes. Yeah, so the phrase I like to use is if you have a perfectly good, sound authenticator and you put it into a perfectly compromised host, whoever is controlling that host has access to those credentials. And so making sure that the credentials are in the control of the user, all factors of that authentication solution should be under the exclusive control of the user that's representing it. So government-furnished equipment is managed with the understanding of the specific threats, and it's more difficult to do that with your own home computer. The information isn't there, or it's the work required to maintain that might not be being done regularly.
Yeah, and you also point out that if you don't have the option of sending hardware home with people, virtual GFE is a pretty good second choice. Can you talk about how close we can get to a secure environment with that virtualized environment?
So the TENS program that is referenced in the document is an Air Force program that basically takes your hardware and allows you to boot to a known good image. So that deals with a lot of the issues regarding, an intruder that might have persistence on the hard drive. It basically forces the adversary to start anew with an attack against your system. And these are refreshed periodically to maintain fairly good protection against the current threats as well.
That's Dr. Alan Lang, Senior Subject Matter Expert for Vulnerabilities and Mitigations at the National Security Agency. One more break, and when we come back, the latest on how the Army is getting soldiers up to speed on the latest in artificial intelligence technologies. That's next on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Servia. Back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Army Futures Command is in charge of modernizing the Army. That includes making sure the workforce has the resources it needs. The command is providing educational opportunities at all levels to help soldiers understand and work with artificial intelligence. For more on how that's all working, Federal News Network's Scott Bassioni talked with Colonel Doug Matty, the Deputy Director of the Army AI Task Force.
The Army initiated what was then called the Artificial Intelligence Task Force in the fall of 2018 and started putting the team together. We hit IOC, or initial operational capability, around 1 February 2019. And so the overall effort was to lead, coordinate, and synchronize the artificial intelligence capability development across the Army. And so, as you would imagine, with the development piece, and we're centered here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is really one of the key areas across the country for expertise and thought leadership in AI, both with the academic partners as well as the industry partners that are here. As we worked through and identified those team members, the key thing that came out to us is there are so many opportunities for artificial intelligence and autonomy to be employed with our capabilities that we needed to start developing a bigger bench, if you will, on how to do that. And so the key thing that we saw with that was leveraging a number of different approaches, because the team that we put together really does kind of cover the gamut of roles and expertise to contribute. So with our effort of having, I'll say, domain experts, i.e. the folks that are the users of these capabilities, embedded with the subject matter experts, whether it's machine learning, whether it's data science, data engineering, et cetera, we wanted to cover all the different facets of roles that we need to have.
So how are you ensuring that your workforce is AI capable for the future?
With our training approach, or I call it the workforce development, we really took a broad approach. First and foremost, the Army is comprised of leaders. And so the initial effort that we put underway was to get after developing and educating the leaders across the Army. We did that by using a couple of different executive education style courses and curricula. So for artificial intelligence, one of the fundamental efforts that you have to have is data and data management. And so we led off with a short course, if you will, that engaged a number of the Army senior leaders to walk them through kind of the first principles of enterprise data management. And then shortly thereafter followed it up, and we're actually still conducting this initial pilot with a data-driven leadership course where you think through or kind of walk the leaders through the different aspects of how do you develop the appropriate infrastructure, for data-driven enterprises. What are some of the techniques and tools that are used for that? What are the requisite skill set that, a leader would want to have in their organization in terms of these roles as we're kind of discussing? And then also, what are good projects? How do you define a project? How do you supervise or manage a project? And what are the, most important, what are the results of these kinds of projects?
But it's not just senior leaders that you're targeting for this program. There's a lot of other people that you're trying to bring into this fold of AI. Who else are you working with?
On three other levels, you kind of get into those folks that are actually doing the artificial intelligence work. And so we have a group that we kind of call the AI professionals. And so just as you would expect, those are folks that have extensive education and backgrounds in this field. And so we were fortunate that we had a number of folks that had participated in the Army's advanced civil schooling programs that we were able to draw from across, our force and bring them in, so they're military as well as civilian. But then we also, as I mentioned, want to grow the bench. And so in doing so, we looked at various programs that were available. And, over about the last 10 years, most folks in industry have heard the terms like big data and data science, realize that it's a fairly unique individual that you can find that can do all of the requisite skill sets that are required to be proficient in this area. And so just like we do with the Army in other areas, we decided we were going to build data science teams. And so we identified two different master's degree programs. We're piloting them at Carnegie Mellon University. Both programs were rated number one in the world in their respective areas. And so we have one program that's focused mostly on the data analytics side of it. And so there's a number of military and civilians that are going through a 22-month program to develop them as data analysts. And then complementary to that is another program that's the computational data science program in the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon as well. But we've chosen a track that really, with the course of sequences, sets them up to be the premier data engineers that we would need. And so when we think about how do we develop data science capacity in the Army, we see that as the teaming of a data analyst with a data engineer. And so as they go through and complete that 22-month program, following that education experience, which is very applied in nature, so they'll work projects both with industry as well as potentially with military projects as well. But as they work through that program and then come out of it after graduation, then we'll pair up that data analyst with that data engineer and have them work either in development labs that the Army has, with some of our other modernization efforts in potentially in some organizations here in our Army and in the institutional side as well as operational.
So you have senior leaders, you have people who are basically AI capable, right? These really educated people. What about the rest of the employees?
We call them the AI technicians. And so that's basically comprised of about a one-year intensive fellowship, if you will. We bring in enlisted, warrant officers, commissioned officers. We're really trying to kind of spread it around, the hierarchy of the military and bring them in for a year. They are given extensive education opportunity, a program that focuses on cloud architecture and how to do cloud solutions. And so they'll be given an education, but at the same time, they're actually working with what I call the cadre here at the Artificial Intelligence Task Force in Pittsburgh on projects that we're working on. So they get that hands-on experience. And so they'll do that over the course of the year to finish out the education and practical application piece of this. And then, for the next 2 years, they can serve as AI technicians, and we'll have them alongside of those data science teams to really help lay in the framework and the foundations of what's needed as we put artificial intelligence capabilities into practice. The other role that the technicians have, though, again, going back to this notion of the Army is about leadership, is that those AI technicians will then, you know, in turn become facilitators for that cloud architecting course. And so each of those technicians will then facilitate a course to another, you know, potentially 25, 30 individuals, and the course itself is already loaded to be distributive in nature. And so the instruction, if you will, can be delivered to anywhere, you know, that we have connectivity for our soldiers.
That's Colonel Doug Matty, Deputy Director of the Army AI Task Force, talking with Federal News Network's Scott Massioni. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Dr. Alan Lang, Senior Subject Matter Expert for Vulnerabilities and Mitigations at the National Security Agency, NSA, just out with a new guide to help agencies securely authenticate their remote workforces. Also spoke with Ryan Prim, the Deputy Director of the Space Development Agency, on how SDA is moving out quickly to build a new space architecture for national defense. If you missed any part of this week's show, you can find the whole episode and all our past ones at federalnewsnetwork.com/ondod or in our podcast feed. Subscribe to OnDOD on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's it for this week's edition of OnDOD. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. I'm Jared Serbio. So long.
You've been listening to OnDOD on Federal News Network. Tune in Wednesday mornings at 11 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.